You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday the 9th of March 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, we're going to start with a bit of news today that confirms everything that we've been seeing and mentioning about the coronavirus. Of course, it's been picked up on that it seems to be affecting Chinese people more than anybody else. And this is very similar to the SARS outbreak, which pretty much only affected Chinese people. And this isn't really being talked about in the media, of course, because they are trying to portray this idea that everybody is all the same, so everybody has the same susceptibility to diseases, which of course is not true. Different races have different diseases that are associated with those races. Particularly Tay-Sachs disease is associated with Jews. Sickle cell anemia is associated with blacks. I think it may be cystic fibrosis is associated with white people, but don't quote me on that. And now we have proof of this about the coronavirus. A study by a Chinese research group has emerged that offers concrete proof that the race differences in susceptibility to coronavirus are very real. The study, a preprint that has not yet been peer-reviewed, is entitled Single-Cell RNA Expression Profiling of ACE2, the Putative Receptor of Wuhan 2019 nCoV, by Yu Zhao et al., and is authored by a group of medical scientists based at Tongji University in Shanghai. The authors explain that 2019 nCoV was reported to share the same receptor, angiotensin-converting enzyme 2, the ACE2 receptor, as the SARS disease, an outbreak of which in 2003 seemed almost exclusively to kill Northeast Asians. Based on the public database and the state-of-the-art single-cell RNA-seq technique, the Chinese scientists analysed the ACE2 RNA expression profile in the normal human lungs. Crucially, they further found, in a comparison of 8 individual samples, that the Asian male one has an extremely large number of ACE2 expressing cells in the lung, in comparison to other races. So the database was based on an analysis of 8 normal human lung transplant donors, but they were all of different races. You see, the Chinese are being sensible here. They are comparing different races rather than just assuming that everybody is the same. As they put it, we also noticed that the only Asian donor, who was male, has a much higher ACE2 expressing cell ratio than white and African-American donors, 2.5% versus 0.47% of all cells. So they got 5 times more of these cells, basically, that are affected by the coronavirus. This might explain the observation that the new coronavirus pandemic and previous SARS coronavirus pandemic are concentrated in the Asian area. So there you have it, scientific evidence of how there are indeed genetic differences underlining the empirical evidence that nationalists have been noticing for weeks, that there are racial differences in susceptibility to the coronavirus, now widely known as COVID-19. And once again, this is an example of how science flies in the face of political correctness and the narrative that people are all the same. We're not all the same. Our eyes do not deceive us. When we see people that look very different to ourselves, that is because they are very different to ourselves, not just physically, but mentally, spiritually. And these are the reasons why they have different cultures to us. And in a lot of instances, cultures that are diametrically opposed to the cultures that we have grown up around white people. This is the source of all these problems that we have with multiculturalism. And now they're really hitting home with the physical differences. And of course, the mainstream media refuses to countenance the fact that there could be racial differences behind this different susceptibility rate. We can look at a report from France 24. They say, whether it is a matter of faulty detection, climatic factors, or simple fluke, the remarkably low rate of coronavirus infection in African countries with their fragile health systems continues to puzzle and worry experts. To date, only 3 cases of infection have been officially recorded in Africa, one in Egypt, one in Algeria, and one in Nigeria, with no deaths. This is a remarkably small number for a continent with nearly 1.3 billion inhabitants and barely a drop in the ocean of more than 86,000 cases and nearly 3,000 deaths recorded in some 60 countries worldwide. And of course, the Chinese have a lot to do with Africa. They've made a lot of investment in Africa. So it's not like there isn't contact between that continent and China. There's been a lot of contact there. So this is the reason. It's racial differences. But they will try and say that, oh, it's just a simple fluke, or it must be the climate. It must have faulty detection. I mean, this is quite encouraging because white lung cells were the same as the black lung cells. So it should mean that white people are far less likely to succumb to this disease. It's quite frightening the way that this can be passed on. There's a lot that the media are not telling us that you can find out from looking at the scientists' reports on this. And strangely enough, one of the best places I've found to find information about this is actually at the Daily Stormer, surprisingly enough. They have been covering this, and they have been covering it in a satirical way, but at the end of each article, they have featured links to all the latest scientific reports and the latest information from China. So if anybody is really wanting to find out about this, that would be a good place to look. At the end of the articles on the Daily Stormer website about coronavirus. And again, this just proves what nationalists have been saying since this started, that it's that the other races are more susceptible to it, particularly the Chinese. And also this shows that there are differences in between the different breeds of whites, because the Italians seem to be particularly prone to getting this, but North Europeans don't. So obviously there is a difference between North Europeans and Southern Europeans, particularly Italians. I mean, there are big differences. Even within the white race, we have different branches of it that have different talents, you could say, different skills sets that they're known for, different ways of doing things. And of course, we look different. But the more you have other races living among you, the less those differences show up. I mean, this is what I was highlighting the other day when I was talking about why I'm not an anti-Semite, why the Jews like multiculturalism, is because when you have multiculturalism, the Jews stand out far less. They look far more just like another white person, because there are people around that look far more different to us and to the Jews. When you just have a fairly homogenous white nation, if you look at how we were a century ago in Europe, it was relatively easy to tell whether somebody was a Frenchman, whether they were German, whether they were Irish, just from looking at them. Because we knew what white people looked like. We knew what our own white people looked like. And we knew what these subtle differences are between the races. And when I went to Lithuania and Latvia, you could see that there was a distinct difference between the Baltic peoples and the people, say, from Germany. I've been to Holland in the past, and you could tell there was a difference between the Dutch and a difference between the English. It's only a subtle difference there, but there was a difference. And of course, there are going to be, because there is this biological difference that we can see with our eyes, there are going to be different biological responses to things such as this coronavirus. So this is good news for white people anyway. And thankfully, at least the Chinese are doing research into these sort of areas, and we can study their results and hopefully apply them to our ways of dealing with this outbreak. Well, the next bit of news that I've got for us today is a little bit closer to the sort of thing that we normally deal with. And this comes out of Denmark. 62% of young Somali migrants have been convicted by the age of 30. Now, how's that for a crime rate? 62%. That's over half of all the young Somalis in Denmark have been convicted of a crime by the age of 30. In fact, not just them either. Over half of all the young migrant men from Somalia, Lebanon and Morocco living in Denmark have been convicted of at least one crime before the age of 30. And what is it that the migrants from Somalia, Lebanon and Morocco all have in common? They're non-white. They all have differing degrees of Negro in their blood. Basically, the Somalians are full Negroes. Lebanon are partially Negro in their heritage. And again, Moroccans are partially Negro in their heritage. And of course, when we look at blacks, wherever they are in the world, they have a very, very high conviction rate. And of course, they blame white people for this and say that, oh, this is just because of racist judges. This is because racist police pick on them more often than anybody else. But when we look at the countries themselves, when we look at a country like Somalia, we can see that it's a war zone. It's full of crime. So it's not that these people are being picked on. It's just that that's the way that they are. And we are fighting a losing battle trying to change these people, as we can see by the overstretched police force that we have, particularly in Britain now, that can't deal with break-ins, it can't deal with charity boxes being stolen, can't deal with shoplifting, been calls to not put paedophiles in prison because we've got far too many people in prison. I mean, we just can't deal with a crime rate like that. When you look at the crime rate amongst white people, which you could, you know, just go back 100 years and look at the number of crimes there were per head of the population, probably about 1% of the population, let alone over half of the population, like it is here with these non-whites. As I say, this report has come out of Denmark. It was by a think tank called UNITOS that delved into crime statistics kept by the Danish Ministry of Justice and looked at the crime rates for men born between 1985 and 1987. And of course, you know, we can look to Denmark here from Britain and say, well, the Danes seem to be pretty good. They've got a pretty good nationalist mentality over there. They've shut the bridge between them and Sweden. They've isolated migrants on an island. They've stopped taking in refugees. And we can see here that they actually keep crime statistics by ethnicity, which is something they no longer do in Britain. They no longer do that in Sweden. They don't do that in Germany. They don't do that in France. And of course, the reason for that is because if they did keep the crime statistics by ethnicity, then people would see who it was that was carrying out the majority of the crimes. And they believe that that would cause societal unrest, So instead of dealing with the problem, they just sweep it under the carpet and pretend it doesn't exist, which just causes it to get worse. And this is the way it has to be dealt with. You have to keep these statistics and you have to make them known so that the real reasons for this increase in crime can be targeted and prevented, and the citizens of a country can be protected from it. The report found that young migrants from certain backgrounds were especially prone to criminal behaviour, with 222 of the 357 Somali young men, 62%, having been convicted of a crime such as violence, vandalism, and theft before the age of 30, Gillan's Posten reports. Now, why might it be so high for the Somalis? Is it just because they're black? I would suggest that there is something else that may also be encouraging the criminal behaviour, and that would be their drug use. They use a drug called cat or murungi, that's what it's called over there in Africa. I don't think it's illegal over here in Britain, and it gets imported by them. And even if it was made illegal, they would still do it, because it's something like 99% of them chew this drug all the time. And it's similar to amphetamines. So they're quite hopped up on these drugs all the time. It's just rife in Somalia. And it's seen as a part of their culture to do this. And it's seen as it would be racist to prevent them from doing this. But I think that may encourage the impulsive behaviour that we see among them over and above just the natural impulsive behaviour that you would associate with black people. For Lebanese migrants, the rate was 60%, and for Moroccans, the rate was 52%. Perhaps they've been using the cat as well, these Lebanese migrants. Migrants from Iraq, Iran, and the former Yugoslavia saw rates of 40%. In contrast, only 18% of the Danish-born citizens had been convicted by the age of 30. And of course, I would suggest that is higher than it would be than if we didn't have multicultural countries. Because if you are living among different peoples that have a much higher crime rate than you have, then you're going to be encouraged to commit crimes as well, because it's going to seem as if everybody around you is committing crimes, and it doesn't matter if you commit crimes anymore. So the Danish-born citizens are also going to be encouraged to break the law. If you get a lot of, say, knife violence or gun violence, then also Danes are going to be encouraged to defend themselves and to get some form of defensive weapon that they can carry on them. And that's going to encourage them to break the law as well. It's like a snowball effect, basically. Once you have crime-prone foreigners living in your country, the crimes don't just go up with the foreigners, but they also go up amongst white people. I mean, we're being encouraged to behave like blacks all the time. We're being encouraged to be materialistic, to show our wealth in our clothes, the rap music that is promoted, which is very violent, very supportive of crime, very materialistic, very all about highlighting promiscuity, all these sorts of things that we associate with blacks. White people are now encouraged to do, and we're encouraged to look up to these black rappers as if they're great heroes, and they're not. Most of the time, they've come from criminal backgrounds, and the only reason why they're not committing so many crimes now is because they've got a music career, and in many cases, even though they do have a music career, they still continue to carry out these crimes. It's very similar to the problem we have in America with a lot of the black sportsmen over there, a lot of the black American football players, and so much of the time they're being accused of rape and gang rape. There are many, many, many instances of black celebrities or blacks that have done very well in life, and yet they're still involved in crime. They think in a different way to us. If you look at their history in Africa, they never developed a system of law. So to understand the way that by committing a crime, you're actually not just hurting that individual person, but you're also hurting the whole of society. That's not the way that they think. It doesn't come natural to them to think that. We try to teach them to think in that way, and I suggest that maybe it's not actually possible for them to think in that way. Because if they didn't come across that idea themselves, if it didn't spontaneously appear within their minds, then maybe they're not capable of thinking in that way, which would tend to find evidence for that in the languages and the words that they use in their languages in Africa. The idea of having abstract ideas such as the whole of society being hurt rather than just one individual when you commit a crime is not something that you would find reflected in their language. They wouldn't have the words to describe that, and we can only come up with words for the things that we can actually think of. You know, so many of the problems that we have today within society could be solved just by facing up to reality, but we don't. We try to pretend that reality doesn't exist, and we insult the people that produce the information and that talk about these things. And we try to silence the people that really do care about their countries and their nations and are trying to do their best for them. Lasse Burke Olesen, the co-founder of UNITAS, commented on the results, saying, "The figures show that a very large proportion of young men from some of the major immigrant countries have been convicted of breaking criminal laws." And of course, this is what was predicted to happen. This was predicted to happen by all the inhabitants of all the countries of Europe. This is what's going to happen if you start importing people from the third world. They're going to start behaving like it's the third world. They're going to bring all the bad habits that they have from their own countries. They're going to bring them into our countries. So it's not like this was something that wasn't expected. This is why I say it's always the governments that are responsible for this rather than the people groups in themselves, because the people groups in themselves, they've always been like this. This is their natural behaviour. The people that are at fault are our own governments for importing them, because there's no way that they can say they weren't aware of this. They weren't aware of the crime rate in Africa. I mean, it's been written about for centuries. So they knew full well what was going to happen, and yet they still imported these people into our countries. So this Lasse Burke Olesen, he's basically just pointing out that this basically confirms everything that nationalists have been saying for the last 50 years. Criminologist David Sosdal, however, expressed caution at the conclusions of the study, claiming that socio-economic factors should be examined and more research done into migrant crime statistics. So what is he saying there? He's saying that the reason for this high crime rate could be because these blacks don't have enough money. They may be unemployed. They may live in poor areas. And because they're living close to poverty, that encourages them to commit crime. And of course, that argument is also put across for why they behave like this in Africa. They say, well, because Africa has a lot of poverty, that's why it has this high crime rate. So all you have to do then is look at white areas that also have poverty and also have unemployment and see whether they have the same number of young white people that are engaging in crime. And of course, you don't find that. You don't find that at all. The poorest areas that are majority white are the rural areas of a country. And the rural areas of a country always have the lowest crime rate. So it can't be socioeconomic factors that are causing this, because we can look at exactly the same situation of white people that are living on the breadline and on the poverty line, and they have the lowest crime rate in the country. So that destroys the criminologist's argument, but of course he's been taught that argument at university. So he's just repeating what he's been told he should be repeating about this, rather than actually thinking about it and applying logic to what he is saying. Last year in June, Danish Justice Minister Søren Pape Poulsen admitted that the country had a problem with migrant criminals following a media investigation that revealed Somali migrants were vastly overrepresented in cases of violent crime. So this is a follow-up to that. I mean, this has also been done in Sweden, even though Sweden has, as I say, they refuse to actually keep records of the ethnicity of the criminals. They do record the names of the criminals, so you can quite easily see who is responsible for all the raping, because they've all got names like Mohammed and Ali and Mo. I mean, they do have a very limited set of names that these non-whites, particularly Muslims, that they choose from. So there are ways of getting around this this attempt to hide the ethnicity of them. So we can see that Sweden has the same figures of migrants engaging in crime. Paulson said the data clearly shows that there is a big problem with criminal foreigners that we should not have in our society. Well, that's good. He's admitting that we shouldn't have this problem. But why do we have this problem? Well, it's because our governments imported it. Earlier in the year, the then Danish government said it would not rule out deporting Somali migrants by force, with then Prime Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen saying, "We have an increasingly good cooperation, which the Somalis attach great importance to, in confidentiality. Therefore, I cannot go into detail with it, but it is a collaboration that also makes it possible, in certain situations, to force people to Somalia, if necessary." So why aren't they doing that? It's about time Denmark started doing that, isn't it? I mean, really, any of these countries in Africa that we send foreign aid to, it should be part of the arrangement that if they are going to receive foreign aid, they also have to receive African criminals that have carried out violent crimes upon our soil. And they should accept that they will be deported there if they commit crimes on our soil. It's madness that we say, oh, we can't deport these people because they have human rights issues in the country that they've come from. If we're sending foreign aid over there, it has to be a part of the agreement that they accept back their own people if we wish to send them back there. And then that's hardly a punishment, is it? Going back to your homeland, being back among your own people. Somali migrants have also been shown to have much higher rates of welfare use and unemployment in countries like Switzerland, where more than 80% of Somalis do not work. So how are these people of any benefit to white countries? How is a people where 80% of them don't work, 60% of them have been convicted of crimes of violence, vandalism or theft by the age of 30, how is that of any benefit to that country? The only place where Somalis are going to be of any use is in Somalia, amongst their own people. That's what needs to be done. That's how you solve this crime rate. You just start by every one of these Somalis that commits a violent crime and gets a prison sentence, you say, well, you, in exchange for your Danish passport, you give up your Danish passport and you accept a Somali one and you go back to Somalia. And the majority of them would voluntarily do that, I would suggest, because it would mean that they wouldn't have to go to prison. I've got another news story that I just want to get into here, which is a really shocking one. This actually comes from Britain. And it's really quite horrifying to think about this. One in four babies are now murdered in the womb. One in four, a quarter of all babies are now murdered in the womb since we legalized abortion. And remember, we were told that legalizing abortion was because somebody might have been raped, they might have been raped by a family member, they may not want to bring up a genetically malformed child, they might have some congenital defects, you know, they came up with all these excuses. And yet here we are, 30 years, 40 years later, and a quarter of all babies are being murdered in the one place that they should be the safest of all. Abortion rates are now at a record high, with one in four pregnancies in England and Wales ending in a termination in 2018. That's 205,295. Yet the abortion rates haven't been driven up by irresponsible teenagers. Teen pregnancy rates have actually fallen by 60% since 1999. It's actually adult women who are deciding they are unable to go through with having a baby at an age when, ironically, nature would much prefer them to have them. The highest number of abortions are being had by women in their early to mid-20s. 35% of conceptions in this age range lead to abortion. So it's even worse when you think about young women at the age of 25. A third of them, if they get pregnant, will murder their baby. And in women in their 40s, for whom there is a 30% abortion rate. Interesting, more than half, 56% of these women have previously given birth. Alarmingly, at the same time, the conception rate has fallen to its lowest since 2014, as has been the trend for the past few years. The only group to see an increase in conception is women aged 40 and over, as prospective mothers delay childbearing until the latest possible point in their fertile lives, and also delaying it until the most dangerous point and at the point where the child will have the least potential and will be more likely to be weak, right near the end of their childbearing life, right near the end when they stop producing eggs. And why is it that they're doing this? They're doing this so that they can have a career. Do they think that having a career is going to bring them contentment as they get older? There's nothing sadder than seeing a woman in her 60s or 70s that doesn't have any children. I mean, grandchildren are the absolute delight of elderly people. The smile that you see on a grandparent's face when they have their grandchild on their knee is just incredible to see. And that has got to be worth more than saying, well, I worked for a bank all my life. What have you got to show for it? If you worked for a bank all your life, you've got these, you may have a property, you may have lots of possessions that you've bought. You can't take them with you. If you've got a family, you've got children, you've got grandchildren, you're going to be spiritually fulfilled. You will be taking those memories with you, and you will have left a family behind you to, for you to continue living through into the next decades, centuries. I mean, I cannot believe that women would be so fooled by feminism as to give up the natural use of their bodies, which is to have children and raise them, and think that what they should be doing is copying the men and doing the things that the men do, when they've been blessed with not having to do that. They've been blessed with being able to produce children. The most important thing there is producing children and continuing the race, continuing the nation, providing descendants for your ancestors. And that's what brings contentment. That's what brings happiness in life. Not working for somebody in the city, not working for some boss, but having a husband who loves them and children who love them and treasure them. The idea that so many women here in Britain are just murdering their babies is just horrific to think about. It's really something that needs to be highlighted, I think. And not just the fact of how horrific this is, but the pleasure and joy of having children and how content that will make somebody. I think that needs to be more concentrated on. The joys of family life, that is something that we really need to be promoting as nationalists. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.